This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code RIOT at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 101. We're recording on Thursday, April 9th. I'm Jeff O'Neill here with Rebecca Shinsky, and we're coming to you from BookRiot.com. We're on the other side of 100. We're back to the news this week.
We are, and it's so much news.
Oh, my goodness gravy.
This is going to be the one-week-long episode of the Book Riot Podcast.
Like, literally, we could be here for a couple hours. There's so much stuff to do.
There's, like, big stuff and meaty stuff to chew on and some ridiculous, funny things. I think my most delightful book story of the year so far is in this week's.
Oh, I think, I wonder if it's the same one.
I bet it is.
I think it is. And we even cut some good stuff.
We did. There were so many links.
It's such a big week. We had to cut a Jonathan Franzen story. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
Our good buddy, Jonathan Franzen. I mean, you know, if there had been a Dan Brown story this week, I don't know what we would have done because we're not cutting that.
We'd have to start a separate Dan Brown podcast. I think that would have been the only responsible thing to do.
You know, somebody on Twitter asked if we were going to send Dan Brown one of our 100th episode Books Are In My Wheelhouse t-shirts, which is a thing that now
that's
I'm dreaming of doing.
It's called podcast bombing, where you send people inside jokes from podcasts
Hi,
they don't listen to.
You don't know us, but we know you. And this is a shirt.
I guess it has the, like, it says, it basically means you like books, the shirt says.
Yeah.
So it's not, like, completely abstruse, but.
And I would just have to write a note about how we really aren't creepy. We just really like
We're
you,
just
and
huge
here's
fans.
A shirt for you to wear. But Dan Brown is not the only one who can have that shirt.
Oh, look
you
at
see
you.
What I did there?
Look at that. That's just a thing of beauty.
If you would like to celebrate the fact that we survived 100 episodes with a Books Are In My Wheelhouse Book Riot Podcast Inside Joke t-shirt, you can buy those through April 15th. So limited time only. They're $16. It's about $20 after you pay for shipping. Teespring, teespring.com/brpodcast.
All right. We have nothing that really fits in this before we do our first sponsor. We usually like to do one a story, follow up, something like that. Mm-hmm. But all of these are too, like, we could do seriously 30 minutes on any of these stories. So let's go ahead and do our first sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it easy, simple, and dare I say fun even to build your own beautiful, responsive website. So here's the deal. If you have ever tried to build your own website, you know, unless you use Squarespace, that it's hard, man. It's just hard to build a good website. So what Squarespace done is they put together a bunch of templates. And these templates, they look great out of the box, but they're also easy to customize. So you want to choose a different font, different colors, arrange. There's this really nice drag and drop feature. You can arrange the content pieces in different ways that you want to. And it looks great on any device from your, well, probably not Apple Watch yet, even though no one has one. I haven't seen that,
pretty much anything else,
from a phone to a laptop to a tablet to a giant desktop, these templates are responsive, which means they make your site look great for whatever screen it's on. It knows what kind of browser situation your reader is looking at any given spot, and it prioritizes and reformats the web page to look great. So there's a bunch of different templates. There's also 24/7 live chat support, which is super great because even as easy as Squarespace is, the internet itself is not easy. And since there's a lot of things you can do to plug into Twitter streams, social media streams, pictures, a free e-commerce solution comes with each Squarespace subscription that's included in the $8 a month with it. Things are going to come up because you're going to try to do something that's important to you, and there may be some problem that you have, and that's why there's great live chat support. when we were doing our own sites back in the day, we did not have live chat support.
Oh man, I so could have used it.
Just even for fun. You know, you work on your website 11 p.m. on a Friday night. Maybe you just need some backup there. So here's what you can do. For 10% off your purchase, go to squarespace.com and use offer code. Oh, I lost my offer code. Do we remember what it is? Oh, no. I'm looking at the wrong thing.
Oh, sorry. Wrong notes?
Wrong
oh,
notes.
Oh, no.
Hold on. I'll come back to that. If you look for that for real quick, I'll do the rest of the deal. You'll get 10% off. And if you sign up for a whole year, you get your own domain name. So if you need JonathanFranzenLovesBirds.org, you can find that. If you really need DBrizzle.com, you could find that. Whatever it is that's available. And there's all these new domain names they have available. Have you looked at some of these domain names like .coffee and
.ninja.
.ninja and .omg. You know, probably can find, it's always a bad sign when Jeff is Googling available domains on a Saturday night, as I was doing the other night.
It's offer code Riot.
Riot. I couldn't remember if it was book Riot or just Riot. So yeah, squarespace.com, use offer code Riot, get 10% off. That lets them know that you came from the show, you heard the ads, that the ads are worth sponsoring, keeps everything going, and it gets you that little deal there too. So thanks so much to Squarespace for sponsoring the Book Riot podcast. Okay. Well,
so many things happened this week. I don't even know where to start.
Well, let's start with an ongoing story. And okay. That is the ongoing publishers versus Amazon story. Mm-hmm. There's not really too much to say about this, except there's a trouble brewing.
Yeah, this feels like so far just like the next second or third or fifth verse, same as the first.
Yes.
But different publisher. Because we've seen this with Hachette. And we saw it to a smaller degree with Simon & Schuster. Like that didn't last as long. Yeah. But HarperCollins agreement with Amazon is about to expire, and HarperCollins is refusing to sign the new agreement with the new terms that Amazon is asking.
And the little birdies are saying that it's the same deal that SNS and Hachette signed. Mm-hmm. So they want Momo. And it makes a little bit of sense because we've seen HarperCollins do some things over the last 6 to 12 months that maybe they've been getting ready for this a little bit. Mm-hmm. They developed, principally among them, I don't know what you think about this too, that they have their own e-retail store. You can buy books directly through HarperCollins.com. So if people are looking for, you know, and presumably if you were going to pull your books from Amazon, you could say, just go buy them on our website.
Well, and they, I think I tested out that app when they, they launched it. And at the time of launch, and I think still currently, if you buy an ebook through the HarperCollins ebook store, you also can only read it in the proprietary HarperCollins reading app, which we don't love. That doesn't have to be permanent. HarperCollins, we've seen be sort of the first mover on a lot of, or one of the first movers on a lot of the forward-thinking digital e-reading stuff. They were one of the first to join Scribd and Oyster and to be checking out subscriptions. They're doing all kinds of interesting things, and that's a smart move, especially if you're preparing to try to give Amazon the middle finger, which it looks like maybe they are.
You'll try to put the screws to them a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, someone that I follow on Twitter this morning, his name's Mark Ferguson, used to work for HarperCollins and now is an author. And we talked about his book a few weeks ago, The Lost Boys Symphony. But anyway, he was talking about how this is really interesting timing for HarperCollins, because HarperCollins just last month announced like the biggest book event of the decade, if not the century, with this Harper Lee book that will be coming out in the summer. And there were a bit like floppity jillion copies of it pre-ordered already. Like we were speculating that they would sell out the pre-order or they would sell out the first run of like a million copies before the book was even in stores. And so they could possibly be dangling that over Amazon. We're going to release the biggest book of the decade and we can do it without you.
Yep. And the other thing that HarperCollins has is it's part of News Corp. News Corp is the parent company, and there are other assets there Amazon might need to worry about if they try to give HarperCollins too much of the job or the business here, because they've got, you know, you may not know this, but Dow Jones and Company is part of News Corp, and they publish this little thing called the Wall Street Journal, some Australian assets, the New York Post, some digital advertising companies, News America Marketing, Amplify Education, which is a digital education company, all these things, you know, and also Rupert Murdoch is the head of News Corp and also the head of Fox, which includes 21st Century Fox. So while they're not the same company, the same dude is at the head of them. And so presumably if you piss off Murdoch and HarperCollins negotiations, he might also saber rattle another location. So there's more chess pieces on the board with HarperCollins than there were for Hachette, which was a part of a big conglomerate but didn't have as many direct assets that they could also sort of threaten with.
SNS
as a daughter corporation of CBS. Mm-hmm. So there's also that there to think about as well. So that's another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, we talked at one point about what would happen if Random House were in this position with Amazon and sort of wishing that Amazon and that Penguin and Random House would be the ones, like they produce 50%, more than 50% of the books that come out in a year. And so if they left Amazon and wanted to roll their own, they probably could. It doesn't look to me like Penguin Random House is gutsy enough to do that. They just aren't trying nearly as many things as HarperCollins is. They're trying stuff, but HarperCollins has been, you know, way out in front. Like, it's just become, when there's a new thing, we're like, oh, well, HarperCollins will be the first one on the list because they're doing this thing. And it'll be interesting to see if it's HarperCollins that goes for it. At some point, somebody is going to not agree to Amazon's something in a more permanent way, at least. And I don't know. I want to see that. I'm just curious. I want to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's maybe going to happen. We don't know what's going to go on there, but I wouldn't be surprised if who knows? Probably. I mean, I'm guessing that it's like April 15, May 1, one of these days is when the contract is up if we're hearing about it already. So we'll see. So that's something we're gonna track. All right. Next?
Yeah, let's go. Well, since we were talking about online ebook stuff and HarperCollins, Oyster, which is an ebook subscription service that we've talked about on the show before, and they have sponsored some episodes in the past.
So yeah, full disclosure, whatever that means to
but
you.
They're going in a different direction than we've seen a subscription service go so far, and they launched an ebook store yesterday.
Yeah.
So now when you log into your Oyster account, which is $9.95 a month for unlimited access to all the ebooks that they have, you can read those, but you can also browse titles that aren't available in their unlimited service, including like everything from Penguin and Random House. Oyster worked with all of the major publishers and a bunch of small publishers for this store. Penguin Random House has not been participating in any of the subscription ebook services.
And they've said they wouldn't
about that
publicly.
Yeah, they've said never.
Yeah.
Which...
It's a long
we
time.
Have all kinds of thoughts about that, but other stories. So Oyster has launched this now, and you can buy books through them. They have deals. There's like a section where you can sort the Oyster store by ebook price, and then you can also see what the free ebooks are, what's available in their unlimited subscription service, and then what you can buy things for. I'm really interested. Like, so far the deals have been, you know, comparable to deals that I see on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and the iBook store. But the regular ebook prices aren't very exciting. But primarily, I guess, because ebooks are, especially for frontlist, tend to still be more expensive. But I was seeing like an $18.99 ebook of a book that's freshly out in hardcover. Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Like, I've been loyal to Kobo because I've loved that some of my
for buying ebooks, right?
Yeah, for buying ebooks. I use subscription services for a lot of my e-reading, but I've been loyal to Kobo for buying ebooks because I've loved knowing that like a little bit of every purchase has gone to a bookstore that I love and want to support in that way. But I might be swayed to throw some of my ebook buying dollars somewhere else if Oyster has good prices, or if they're able to get like cool exclusive deals or something.
We were talking about a lot, both of us on Twitter yesterday, then in the Book Riot back channel stuff, just sort of puzzling it out and why are they doing this and is this interesting or not. I guess if you're a regular Oyster user, it's a nice perk, right? Because you search for you know, you don't, I think most readers, even serious ones, like the kinds of people that use Oyster, don't necessarily know what publishers publish the authors and books they're looking for. So say you punch in Beloved by Toni Morrison, right? It doesn't, if you're just using Oyster, you get no result, or maybe they recommend something like it, but it's not it. Here, at least, you get the options like, well, it's not in your subscription, but you could buy it right here, right now, and just pick it up. So they're capturing, I guess, some of that purchase intent maybe from their existing customers. I don't think it's enough to convert anyone that's not already using Oyster.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to, I don't think it's a, I think you were asking, is this like a Trojan horse for something? And I don't think that it is. Like, if you're not already using Oyster, so far there's no incentive to start buying your books at Oyster now, just because you can. You know, we know readers have a lot of places they can buy books, and it's the buying patterns are very established, and most people who are e-reading are buying from Amazon, and this is not, I don't think, going to lure any of those people away. But if you're using Oyster already, it is an interesting add-on. The downside is that you can't do purchases in the app because it's an iOS device.
This is one of the reasons most of my ebooks are through iBooks, frankly, because I just pop right there.
Which, like, if you read on an Apple device and you're not reading in iBooks, you've experienced this problem with all of it. Like, I have to go on my laptop to Kobo to buy books, and then they show up on my Apple devices.
Which is Bummer Central. Continues to be Bummer Central for Audible and whatever.
Like, it's just so Bummer Central.
And
so
when Comixology went to Amazon and they took in-app purchase out, it's just I don't know what you could do on Android. Can you buy in Android? Can you buy right there? I don't know what the rules are, I have to say.
It is a total bummer that that's the way that it works, but it's not any more severe of a bummer for Oyster than it is for any other ebook purchasing platform.
Except first, you know, iBooks or something like that.
But they do have, I think Oyster has great discovery tools, and you can scroll and build giant reading lists. And so now you'll be able to see what you can, all the books that are in the subscription service have like a little banner across them that you can see on the cover when you're scrolling. And then if it doesn't have a banner, you know, that's something that you would have to buy. And there's some filters where you can like search for, you know, books about dragons and only see the ones that are in the unlimited offering, or only see the ones in the store, or both. So there's lots of choices. It's interesting to see them do this.
It's just interesting.
I don't know that I would have guessed that this was going to be their next move.
No, me neither. I was trying to think about, do you make this move out of position of strength or weakness, right? Most businesses do one out of two. You know, they're trying to grow something, or and they're doing it because they think they can double down on a strength or enter a new market because of whatever reasons, or they're trying to figure out something that works. And the only way, again, I've said this on Twitter yesterday too, that it's not a great sign for me that they're not talking about subscriber numbers. Usually a startup that has a bunch of subscribers, like you hear about that. Like you hear about big, exciting companies that they've got X number of uniques a month or something like that. Now, it doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad sign. They could be doing it for competitive reasons. Maybe in this great Scribd versus Oyster war, the other one doesn't really want to let the other one know sort of how many they have, or, you know, make people – anyway, there could be reasons that the numbers are good and they're not telling us. But I think it's probably unlikely. And they did release one stat I thought was interesting, Oyster, in this round of press releases that was embargoed until yesterday, blah, blah, blah. And that is, they said Oyster users are reading 100 million pages a month.
Wow.
Which seems like a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I started, it's like, well, can I make a guess about how many, can I make a guess from that about how many subscribers they might have?
Ah, okay.
Right? Because they can't, you're not reading a million pages a month. Right?
No.
And I don't think the average reader is reading 10 pages a month. So let's say the average book is 300 pages and the average Oyster user reads one book a month. Those are just assumptions. I have no idea if they're right. We don't know anything. But that's not unreasonable, right?
For like hand-waving guess math, it's not bad.
Yeah, hand-waving, magic, magical thinking. Here we go. This is going to be bang on right is what I'm trying to say here. So if you each user averages 300 pages a month, you know, some a lot more, some a lot less, but it comes out to average at 100 million pages, that is 33,000 subscribers a month at 300 pages. Now, I think it's more than that, probably, because we saw some numbers out of Scribd, which, like, you know, their people, the Scribd was saying their users reading a lot more that way. So if you use those numbers, which might be 2 to 3 books a month, then you're really looking at something like 8,000 to 12,000 subscribers.
Yeah.
And boy, that doesn't sound great to me. Does it to you?
No, it doesn't. I think the first and only time that we saw numbers out of Oyster was like not too far after their launch. And it was something like, you know, they had broken 5,000 monthly subscribers. Mm-hmm. And then we haven't seen numbers. We haven't seen real numbers from Scribd. I remember there was a TechCrunch piece that we talked about on the show several months ago where Scribd said something that was like an astronomical number of global users.
Yeah.
And we were parsing all the different ways that people can use Scribd.
Yes, because Scribd is more than a subscription.
Right, that aren't the ebook subscription, and that they hadn't broken out what that looks like. Like, publishers use Scribd to post excerpts of books, and then they use those excerpts as landing pages from their banner ads.
Yeah, some of the ads that we run on the site go to Scribd.
Right, it says, you know, it has like the cover of the book, and it says click here to start reading or click here for an excerpt, and that takes you to a Scribd page, and writers use it to post things, and there are all kinds of uses for Scribd that aren't their subscription service. And I remember we were like, well, this is hand waving. Also, because they're also not revealing.
Right. They're not revealing different numbers.
Yeah. I wonder for Oyster if this was a move towards establishing relationships with the publishers that they weren't going to be able to work with if they stuck to the subscription only model. And maybe in that way, it's a Trojan horse, or at least like a foot in the door effort
to
work with Penguin Random House and then promote the hell out of it and hope that people buy enough books that they can then go to Penguin Random House and say, look at all of these books that you've sold because of Oyster users. These people are into your titles. Maybe you want to start trying just a few of them in the subscription service.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of people looking for your books.
Yeah. Blah, blah,
and they're not buying them, but if they were in the subscription, you'd get X percentage of the sale price.
Right, if they can be like, you know, 1,000 people searched for Beloved this year, and of those 1,000, this many of them bought it. And we, based on whatever magical math we're doing, we think that if, you know, 12 of them bought it, then 75 of them would have read it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm making up numbers. But they could do some guessing about if this many people are willing to invest the dollars just to read your title, then this many more people would have read your title if it had just been in the unlimited and you would have gotten paid for those reads. Because Oyster and Scribd both, I pay the publisher after the reader read, like consumes
like
the first 10% of the book.
Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting. It's unexpected. Yeah, I was saying to Clint yesterday, I was like, you know, Netflix is the example company in any media subscription, and so it's Netflix for books or video games or even Legos and stuff like that. Now you can get, and I was like, if it was really a good idea, don't you think Netflix would have done it? You know, I kind of don't like that kind of reasoning, but Netflix easily could be selling movies through its app, right? You know, through on your phone. It's like, Avengers isn't available right now, but buy it right now for $5.50. And you know people would. The other thing about buying books through Oyster or Netflix for that matter is like, I'm assuming they're DRM'd. Can you only read them on Oyster?
I don't know.
Because if that's the case, I wouldn't be buying ebooks. Because I don't know. They're 18 months old. Like, who knows if they're going to be around? I have a pretty good sense that Apple and Amazon and Google are going to be around. So even though I don't love DRM, at least I'll know I'll have some way of reading them with Oyster.
We'll have to do our homework and find out.
Yeah, I bet we can find out about that. Because I didn't see that in any of the press releases, and I don't currently have an Oyster subscription, so I didn't bop in there to take a look.
I will have to check.
And if any of you readers try this out and you run into media, or checking out Oyster and try buying stuff, let us know what you see or find out, and we sure like to talk about it, report it to let everybody else know about it. So that's interesting for sure. Yeah. Other interesting things.
Go to the most delightful bookstore.
Yeah, let's go to it. Let's go to this.
I am unreasonably entertained by this story.
We're both talking about Rushdie, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we are.
So Salman Rushdie, it came out a few days ago that he has been reviewing and rating, I guess just rating books on Goodreads. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he hasn't been writing reviews.
And I don't know why this came out, but someone came across his profile and saw that he was rating stuff kind of surprisingly, like 3 stars to Kill a Mockingbird or Kingsless Amos got 1 star for Lucky Jim. And I guess some people on Goodreads started questioning his judgment, but it turns out he thought the ratings were private.
It's so great.
And he responded saying, "I'm so clumsy in this new world of social media. Sometimes I thought these rankings were a private thing designed to tell the site what sort of book to recommend to me or not to recommend. Turns out they are public, stupid me. Well, I don't like the work of Kingsley Amis. There it is. And I don't have to explain or justify. It's allowed." Isn't that awesome?
It's so awesome. I love it. Salman Rushdie's don't care juice is so strong. Yeah. He's like, well, I don't like Kingsley Amis. I don't have to tell you why.
I think he has don't care blood. It just like throws through his veins.
You know he does. It's so great. I also loved, like, Salman Rushdie's kind of great on Twitter. So
yes,
it seems a little possibly disingenuous to me that he's doing the, like, I'm so clumsy in this new world sometimes. Like, he's figured out Twitter. But the thing that's really interesting to me is, like, why is Salman Rushdie using Goodreads to get book recommendations?
That's the thing. I don't care that he gave 3 stars to To Kill a Mockingbird. Frankly, I'm not surprised that he doesn't really particularly like To Kill a Mockingbird.
I don't care about that in the least. But why does Salman Rushdie have a Goodreads account in the first place?
I thought these rankings were a private thing designed to tell the site what sort of book to rec. Don't you think he could get some recs from somebody?
Right. Like, is Salman Rushdie sitting around at 1 a.m. like while we're poking around on our Squarespace accounts? He's like, I really need something to read, and nobody
like,
ever talks
the recommended book sidebar, and I don't get it.
I'll just jump into this pool with 25 million people and trust them to recommend stuff to me.
Or maybe he was just farting around with it. You know, he's like trying it out. What happens if I raid a few books?
Right.
What does it give me? I didn't look at his profile, I have to
say. Like,
so I
want him to continue this. Like, now that he knows it's public, I want him to just continue it and keep rating things and then do it as like performance art of like, here are the things that Goodreads has recommended to me based on not really liking To Kill a Mockingbird and really not liking Lucky Jim, and I'm going to read some of those and write about them now.
It's Salman just Rushdie, so beautiful. It's
he's
just
a
such
beta
a
tester, like 10
story.
Years late. It's just such a delight. Like and you can imagine so many other authors spinning this in such the wrong way, you know, of like backpedaling about how they, like, you know, the Goodreads version of like, I didn't send that DM with my private parts in it, I got hacked. Like, you can imagine people being embarrassed about their ratings or saying that, like, their kids set up the account or someone set up the account in their name. Like, people could make up all sorts of explanations for why they were giving low ratings to beloved books. And like, we know better than anybody on the internet probably what happens when you say you don't love a beloved book, because it happens to our contributors sometimes.
Also, but bad job, like, Goodreads commenters that questioned his judgment. Bad job. Bad job. He can like what books he wants to like.
He can totally like what books he likes. You know, and I think that's a really great, interesting thing too, is Rushdie is seen as a, you know, a very literary, like highbrow writer, and for him to be like, well, I can like whatever I like, it doesn't matter, I don't have to explain it to you, I don't have to justify it, it's allowed, there it is, Lucky Jim gets 1 star, is a cool example to set for readers.
Very cool.
You know?
And of all the people not to care, I mean, when you've had a death sentence on your head for several decades, I don't think Goodreads trolls are going to bother you too.
Yeah, this ranks pretty
low. Flummoxing is not in his game at this point.
Yeah, I would guess he's pretty unflappable. But yeah. I loved everything about how the story came out and what the
story
was. I love
that he's using it. I love that he didn't know. I love we get it. I love his response.
It's
everything
so great.
Is great.
It's all so perfect.
Yeah, this is what we internet for, to get stuff like this. If you go search for, I don't know, his profile, I'm sure is still public unless he took it down.
Probably. I haven't gone and looked for it.
I haven't gone and looked at it.
But we know a lot of y'all are on Goodreads, so go
follow. 5 stars to Great Gatsby from Mr. Rushdie.
Okay. Well,
and Evelyn
he and
Waugh.
I can still be friends then.
Okay. Let's not go to a delightful story. Actually, two not
just
going to
make some sounds for a second.
This is not something we know a lot about, the Hugo Awards, which are awards for science fiction and fantasy with an odd voting structure, which basically if you're a supporter and you pay $40, you get the right to vote. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And then there's maybe another level where you can nominate for voting. Mm-hmm. So it's both open and closed. It's basically a poll tax to be a member of this particular kind of award. And over the last several years, the Hugo Awards, the nominations and the winners, frankly, have become more diverse. I don't believe there's been sort of an official group championing the increased diversity of the nominations and the winners, but amongst people voting and nominating, making sure that diverse stories and writers and authors are included has been at least a unspoken priority. Does that seem fair to you, what I'm describing?
It does seem fair. We've been, publishing in general and the literary internet has been having this conversation about diversity, and it's a thing that readers have been paying more attention to, and people who care about books, and you care about books and reading if you're paying $40 or more to join an organization so that you can nominate and vote for books that you love. And there's been a real emphasis, I think, in the group of Hugo participants on highlighting the great work that's being done by the full spectrum of writers, not just shining the spotlight on the same writers that always get the spotlight.
Yeah. And so last year was kind of a watershed year for the awards, and basically swept by younger writers that are women, people of color. And in response, because of course someone has to have a response, a group called Sad Puppies.
Which, perfect.
He couldn't make it up. Like, The Onion couldn't do this anymore.
Right.
Put together an orchestrated campaign to get their nominees nominated. And in pretty much every category other than Best Novel, came exclusively from this effort from Sad Puppies, organized by Brad R. Torgensen and Larry Correa. Last year, Correa had organized a campaign which successfully placed one nominee in each of the categories from their sort of list of approved whatevers. The nominees this year are all messed up again, or they're all horrible, significantly influenced by this campaign.
And the pieces that we've been reading, and one of our contributors, Chris Arnone,
wrote a very nice piece.
Yeah, did a bunch of reading for it and a bunch of research, and the overarching theme seems to be that the Hugo Awards have always had this element of campaigning, that because, you know, people can reach out to their fans and say, hey, if you want me to win this award, then please register and vote so that you can vote for me. Writers big and small have been doing that for a long time in the Hugos. So the notion of campaigning is not new, and it sounds like factions, you know, this is not the first time that factions have popped up within Hugo voting and nominating. But this response was, you know, last year there was a really great diverse group of winners, and Torgerson and Correa this year wrote about that, how this rarefied insular group of writers were promoting an agenda by nominating works by women and people of color. And they felt that their chances of being recognized and sat the members of Sad Puppies, which, God, it's just so perfect. chances of being recognized were threatened by the agenda of this other group. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, they have organized this campaign to get essentially white people recognized again.
White dudes, especially.
And the racist factions of the internet have come out to support them, which I tend to think, like, if the trolls are coming out to support the thing that you're doing, whether you intended or not to be on the same side as the trolls, first of all, that's a pretty foreseeable consequence. And so it's like a failure of imagination that those people aren't, that if you don't think that those people are going to show up and be on your side, but you should maybe interrogate where you're standing on things. If it's like, if it's the people who hate women coming out to support the thing that you're doing, or the people who, you know, hate people of color coming out to support the thing that you do, you might not be working from a place of active hate, but you're also maybe not working from a place of active good. And if the response to seeing the awards in your field being more diversified is not, wow, this is great because this field is diverse and the awards are the best and most effective when we have the widest possible scope of nominees and winners, but now I'm scared that I won't get recognition, that's also worthy of interrogation.
The cover of it seems to be that these guys think that the awards have become too literary and not popular enough. Like, the line, there's a lot of lines, like, you know, while the wider world is out gobbling Avengers, the Hugos are recognizing these sort of more literary works that are political in nature and blah, 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 which I think is just sort of bogus. Like, whatever. Like, okay, so there's people like the Avengers. That doesn't mean the Avengers won the Academy Award, right? That's not how this works right. necessarily. It's just an odd thing. And I don't know. I guess I'm not surprised by it, to be honest. I think it sucks. It should be said, just for even sake of discussion, that they didn't do anything outside the spirit or rather the letter of mm-hmm. the Hugo process. There's nothing that says you can't organize a campaign. They paid their yeah. money and they did their thing. So that means that the Hugos now have a problem because these people mm-hmm. exist. And right. I don't think anyone's going to change their mind. And it's going to become, if the Hugos don't do something about it, much more like a political campaign mm-hmm. where there are sides that have different agendas and things they care about and they're going to organize their people in different ways. And you know that the people who care about other things than these sad puppies do, they're going to organize something of their own and do something next year.
And there is that unintended but real consequence of the people who just exist on the internet to, you know, fight against diversity yep. are going to show up on your side and are going to, you know, spend money and register to vote and skew the results. 'Cause that's a thing that people devote time and thought
yep.
to doing now. And so, yeah, if you're the Hugos, you have a big problem. We saw this, I was talking, I think, on the back channel. We saw something similar, but not in the book world, at the end of the year last year when Time Magazine does a poll at the end of every year about, like, which word should we outlaw right. next year? Like, you know, what's the thing you're tired of hearing about? And it's usually pop culture words, you
or
know, like
slang or something
right,
like that.
You know, like twerking or whatever. And feminist was one of the words on the list. And, like, you know, they had an explanation for why that was. And it wasn't that they hated feminism. It was that they thought too many people misused it. And so we needed a new term. But, you know, like the men's rights activists organized campaigns to go and vote for
so
it.
So many fedoras.
And so their show title. It was in the lead of the vote for a long time. And notably, I don't recall ever seeing the results of the vote. Like, I don't think Time ever publicized.
Good point. I didn't notice the results of the vote either.
Because how are you going to be like, oh, right, we got trolled because we didn't anticipate that we were going to get trolled if we put this word on our poll. And so now we have these results that are the results of trolling and not of, like, what the internet's democratic process so they just kind of – it just faded away yeah. because they didn't want to go with that. And I'm afraid that the same thing might be happening to the Hugos and to other, you know, other things that can be campaigned and voted for online, because it's not just limited to the community that really cares about that thing
right.
anymore. Your vote will not necessarily reflect – like the results are not necessarily going to reflect the real values and priorities of your community.
Or
other groups with other priorities and agendas come in to support your side to make their point.
Or how about this? Maybe your community doesn't have a monolithic agenda or yeah. taste. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, do you want your award to be divisive? Like, what do you want to do with the – I mean, that's – I don't know who's in charge of Hugo. I have no idea how it's set up, like, and from an administrative point of view. But presumably someone has the power to use the brand and the name and however they want to do it. Like, if you're the Hugo, what do you want the award to be?
Right.
Because these days and our internet days of, like, getting a popular vote, I think most of the time you're going to be sort of upset with your result, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think, like, they're going to have award discussions and nominees and winners that look like unmoderated comments at the bottom of websites.
Yep.
Like, that's what it's going to look like, because it just doesn't work, because you're going to have people that have a lot of energy and they're going to use it in ways that don't reflect well on you or the people you think you're representing or want to participate in your organization doing stuff that you don't want. And that's why, I'm surprised a little bit that Goodreads hasn't had this problem. Maybe it's just they're so big that 1,000 people can't get into it. Where the Hugo nominations are like 1,000 per category. So
yeah, Goodreads is so big. And when we talk about the results of the Goodreads Reader's Choice Awards at the end of every year, you can point to a few of those that are undoubtedly affected by how large the author's online mm-hmm. following is.
But also the nominations are editorial.
Right.
And
so
the winners, they winnow it down, but they don't let the nomination. Yeah. The
right.
Whole
Goodreads makes that first makes that first cut. It's not just open.
I think that's what the Hugo should
to
do.
To everybody. I think so too.
Maybe they take nominations and then kind of like we do with our charitable voting. Like we ask people to give us nominations. We sort of come up with a list we're happy with. We think this is a good list. And then open it up from there. Because like this is absurd. Mm-hmm. Like one guy, John Wright, has three nominations in Best Novella. Three of the five are one guy.
Sorry, no.
I mean, I guess it's technically possible, but come on. So it's a watershed moment for the Hugo, and it's a watershed moment for how these fandoms that are no longer insular, you know, these are part of wider popular culture now. And you know, it's kind of like being a Mac user, just because there's not as many of us, we're not as open to virus attacks because there's just not as many people, you know, there's not mm-hmm. as many Macs as there are PCs in the world. So we're not as big of a target, but now sci-fi and fantasy is a big thing. And just like the reason the Avengers are big, there are a lot of people reading sci-fi, paying attention to it. The internet is big and getting reach all the way out there. So you no longer have sort of a, I don't know, almost a, being sort of the last tribe in the Amazon protected from the outside world. The outside world's here. It's on your doorstep. And the old ways of doing things don't work when the whole internet is paying attention.
Right. And when the whole internet can buy their way into the process.
Yeah. I don't know if it'd be better or worse if you just got rid of the $40 fee. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, I don't know either. It's interesting.
When you have a small group and a poll tax and...
I kind of suspect it would be worse because then you'd have, like, I think, like, more trolls than who maybe aren't going to spend
$40.
Just like $40.
A 4chan flood could come rolling in.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Man, we have so much left to talk about,
Jeff. I know. We better do another sponsor.
Yeah,
Where
we got to go
what
to...
What day is it?
We are... right. It's a cold, bright day in April.
Oh, it is. Well, it's cold here, at least.
The clocks are striking 13. Striking 13. So Scribd is our sponsor. Again, this week, the good folks at Scribd are back. We've been talking about subscription services on this episode. And if you have been thinking about trying one and you want to know what that is all about, this is a good day for you, my friend, because Scribd is a subscription book service that gives you unlimited access to a library of more than 500,000, which is a lot, ebooks, audiobooks, and comics. You go to Scribd, scribd.com/bookriot to get started. You'll get a whole month free. You can try so many books in a month.
So many.
And a thing that we talk about with subscription services all the time is how much we love that they open up the door for you to try whatever you want to try with no risk and no friction. So you've never read a comic and you're not sure that you, like, you don't know which comic shop to go to. You don't know which comic you want to read. You can just poke around on Scribd and see what looks interesting and give it a shot. And if you love it, you can binge read because they have a cool, like, button that you press to binge read. And if you don't love it, then you just close it and you try something else and you're not out any additional dollars from your experiment. It's a great way to diversify your reading life in all the possible directions that you can diversify your reading life at really low risk. They have books inscribed from a lot of the major houses like our pals at HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, HMH, also innovative small presses like McSweeney's and Counterpoint and Tin House. With the subscription, not just the 500,000 ebooks and audiobooks, they have, 500,000 ebooks, 30,000 audiobooks, a ton of comics. I don't think I've seen a number there yet, but there are a bunch.
There's some Daredevil I saw recently. There's a bunch on there.
Yeah. They have curated lists that are made by their team of editors, and it tailors recommendations based on how you rate the books. So if you're pulling a Salman Rushdie and giving things low or high ratings, the Scribd algorithm is looking at that, and they recommend based on what you like and what you didn't like. It tailors in both directions. So Scribd.com/bookriot right now to get your 1 month of free access started, 30 days of unlimited reading, listening, and comics digging in. Pretty soon that page will also bear a list of recommendations from us from books that we've loved. If you're going to try a comic, my favorite thing in the world, Lumberjanes, is on Scribd right now. It's about a group of girls at a summer camp, and there's mythology and feminist references and some magic, and it's just so, so much fun. It's great whether you are whether you're looking for a kid or for an adult. It's kind of a readers of all ages thing, but with lots of winking jokes for the adult readers. And a really great funny memoir slash, like, I don't even know how to pitch this book, but Baratunde Thurston has a book out called How to Be Black that came out a few years ago that's a memoir of, you know, about growing up Black in American culture. And he's a cultural figure, so also kind of what that is like. But how do you understand the Black experience if you are a person who's not Black? And then how we talk about race and racial, our experiences as people of different races in American culture. And it's smart. It's really funny. I thought it was a lot of fun. And that's available in Scribd as well. So those are two
nice
appetizers to get you started. Thanks again.
Thanks again.
To Scribd for sponsoring. When you go to scribd.com/bookriot to get your 30-day free trial, it also lets them know that you came from us. So hopefully they will continue to sponsor. We can keep doing this thing. And if you're in there and you need any recommendations, you can always holler at us on Twitter or let us know what you've been reading on Scribd, and we'll give you some other places to go.
Vida. Which week. In any normal week would be the big story. I guess maybe it still is the our big story of the week, really. There's just so much else that's interesting. The 2014 Vida Count came out this week. Vida, which is an organization which promotes women in literary art, basically. Mm-hmm. And their big annual project is a count, which we've talked about on the show. We talk about every time it comes out. Always look forward to it with both interest and dread. And basically what they do is they pick some influential literary publications and they look to see how many women are represented as reviewers and how many women are represented as getting their book reviewed. And it's never great. It has shown improvement over the years. Mm-hmm. Some notable improvements among some of the publications that really seem to care, Tin House being one of them. The New York Times Book Review has never said openly that they're actively trying to do or pay attention to Vida, but the numbers suggest that if they're not, they're doing a heck of a job anyway. And then there's the annual laggards that continue to be laggards. Mm-hmm. Basically, if you have a review of books in the name of your publication, you suck with women. Because the New York Review of Books, the London Review of Books are just horribly, horribly dude heavy.
And the Times Literary Supplement. Yeah,
the English publications come out looking terrible here, especially as a group. The ones that perform relatively better, Boston Review has made a concerted effort, I believe, as well. Granta, Poetry
71%
Magazine. 71% this 71%. Year. Let's see what else. As I said, the NYTBR comes out looking pretty good. Tin House.
McSweeney's made a big jump. They had 23%.
That is
women.
That's right.
Yeah. So the Vida numbers, and we'll put all the links in the show notes. You can look at breakdowns by the gender of the reviewers and breakdowns by the gender of the authors whose books were reviewed and a few other variables for each publication. But then there's one that's like the master graph for each publication, which mm-hmm. Vida talks about that as a pie, but they're not pie charts this year. But last year, McSweeney's women only had 23% of the pie. And this year, women got 48% of the pie.
That's a statistically significant jump.
It is. It's a really big jump. So across being reviewers or having their books reviewed or a few of the other ones. What else? Oh, in the other direction, the Ninth Letter, which I think is a literary journal. This is under the Not Great Bob section of my notes about it, but they had a big negative change down from 62% to 34%. The Times Literary Supplement is holding steady.
That's the worst one, isn't it?
It is the worst one. Yeah. That's the stinker. 27%. Women have had 27% of the pie in coverage pretty steadily for the last 4 years that Vida has been doing this count. But like you said, the Boston Review is at 71% this year. You don't get there by accident.
Most of the graphs are showing steady, small year-over-year mm-hmm. improvements, except for the stinkers. You know, and The Nation, Vida, TLS, right. NYRB. Those ones just sort of suck. Actually, NYRB is a little better this year. Little bit better. I'm sorry.
A little bit better. When Vida launched, they said, and what they've continued to say, is that the first part of their mission is just to bring these numbers to visibility, to point out here is what publications that are perceived as important and or powerful or prestigious in the literary world. Here is how those publications are doing with respect to women. These are the actual numbers, which is incredibly useful.
Oh.
in conversations with people who were like, well, where's your proof that sexism is a problem? Okay, buddy, would you like to see my pie chart?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I don't know what else you want.
But sort of one of the principles of causing change in anything, whether it's your personal life or an industry that you're a part of or your work or your family, is first you turn attention to that thing.
Or and you so measure, it, you get some sort of stat, right?
Yeah, like, you turn your attention. You watch the thing. It's kind of the same thing, I think, as how, like, if you keep a journal of, if you're trying to lose weight or get healthier and you keep a journal of what you eat and how frequently you move your body, just
budgeting too is famous for that. If you just write down how much you want to save and how much you actually save, you actually end up saving more.
Right. Just the simple act of turning attention to measuring a thing can cause change or can be the catalyst for change. And so while, like, the New York Times Book Review, as you were saying, hasn't come right out and said that this is a thing they're working on, having those numbers be public and knowing that the public of industry publications, you know, of and the literary internet are paying attention, likely is causing some conversations behind the scenes, or someone is paying more attention.
We're talking about it. People are thinking about it. We get notes all the time. So it's like, as you guys have talked about it, I pay more attention and blah, blah, blah. And this helps us, you know, gives us something to
You have real numbers. It gives people something to pay attention to. And, you know, there's a piece of it that, like, sort of always comes out around the Vita numbers of, like, whether these publications are really important or not, or whether they're really representative of publishing or not. And I think you and I share the opinion that sort of where the power is in, like, the wider reading community and in who's talking about books and how we talk about them has shifted and is continuing to shift. But I think that Vita is smart to do it this way because publishing is slow to change.
Right.
And publishing still very much thinks that a small group of elite publications are the ones that matter.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to cause change, you point out the problems in the places that the industry has already decided matters, and you work on those and let, you know, other groups and other publications do what they're doing to create their own change too. But I think it's important to point out, like, the New York Times is the publication of record for publishing. And so we should look at who gets coverage there and how.
Yeah, because, like, some people asked us, actually people asked me on Twitter specifically, I don't know if they asked you, like, why, you know, why isn't BookRiot on this or other kinds of sites, BuzzFeed or The Millions or, you know, online only places. And said, well, I think it's sort of not the point. You know, it doesn't really matter what individual publications you pick. Probably the only one I'd say you have to do if you want to do this is the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Everything else you could kind of throw in a bucket. You know, the Washington Post isn't on here, which it easily could be.
Sure.
Or the LA Times or anything like that. But, you know, it could be because, like, I think, you know, maybe I'm hubristic, but I think probably in aggregate we're as influential as, say, the Boston Review, I would think. So it's not really about influence in a sort of selling book sort of sense, but it's
or like
more,
absolute influence.
Yeah, absolute influence.
Perceived literary eliteness.
Also,
maybe.
Good luck doing the Vita count on BookRiot. I don't even know how you would do it.
We were talking, like, we'd have to figure out the counting system and then enter it in every day as we went,
like,
for
every
a year.
Borrow bypass or genre kryptonite and every best books we read this month or what I'm reading. Like, I don't even know how you, because we don't really reviews, but we talk about books a lot. So it's a
but
very
we do.
Weird
we
thing.
Are keeping stats about, we are keeping stats about the what shows up in the best books
Amanda
we read this
that.
Month and a few, I think a few of the other recurring. So we're keeping stats and we'll do our own count
but
at the end of the year.
But it's not definitive by any sort of what we cover.
Right.
So that's
it's
one thing that's
selection.
Interesting to think about too, is that this is not everybody. So, you know, this is, Vita is going to continue to do this. I think it continues to be an important piece. The new piece this year is they did Women of Color. So they sort of, it's sort of, we've been wondering about this too and openly asked, not in a you should be doing this way, but as boy, it'd be interesting to know the racial and ethnic diversity of the women that are writing. And oh my God.
It's so bad.
It's worse. It is worse than I thought. I think
the methodology
I was looking at
is,
it is worse than,
like,
I thought.
It is. It's the methodology is really interesting.
Not their methodology,
so I want to, like,
not Vita, like the results are.
Yeah, yeah. The methodology is great. It's really interesting how they did this. Rather than just looking at the women's names that were published in these 15 publications that they count and, like, Googling and trying to figure out what race they were, and having the Vita people assign a race, a racial identity to each writer for the purposes of the count, they went the route of self-identification. Yeah. And they said, it's a great quote, we are not qualified to determine and assign race to any writer of the more than 2,000 in the 12 publications that we've traditionally counted. They wanted those writers to have the power and the control over how they identified and to respect that. So they reached out to the publications in the count and went through editors, and sometimes they emailed the writers directly. They had this master spreadsheet of all the women that were featured in these publications that they count, and they went through multiple rounds of trying to reach them. They sent a survey to them asking them to self-identify their race, and they got responses from more than 45 or from 45 self-identified categories, mm-hmm. Which is fascinating in itself. And then they broke it out that way. But the charts are, despite the fact that people from more than 45 self-identified categories responded, the charts are basically like, here are the bajillion people who identified as white. And then there were like three women from this publication that identified themselves as Asian and one person that identified as Black.
So for context, we've used this number sort of internally, both to check our own sort of diversity and where we want to be eventually. And we're ahead of most all of these places. But and the number we keep coming back to is around 33 to 36% of Americans are people of color. So that's gives you some sense of what the actual distribution of humans in America are. And not all of these are, you know, some of these are British. So if you're trying to get a sense, because we're going to give you some of these numbers, and I just want you to have context for how bad they are.
Right.
So, you know, these are just the women. So already underrepresented in literary, these journals, right? Already underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you start with the worst? How about let's start with the best?
Okay. Tell me what the best is, Jeff.
God, I don't even know. What is the best? In terms of percentage? Well, I mean, I don't even know what to make of this. So like Granta, there's 9 respondents for the women of Granta writing, and mm-hmm. 6 of them are white, 1 Hispanic, 1 Black, 1 Asian. And that's okay. Good as a percentage, because mm-hmm. that's like 3
right,
of 9, like, 33%.
Right,
so that's,
30, yeah.
You know... That's good. That's where you mm-hmm. want to be. But it's also such a small sample size. Let's go with something with a big sample size. How about, I don't know. Well, let's go with a big boy. Let's go to the New York Times Book Review. Where is he?
Okay.
Where is he, tellingly?
That's
New York Review of Books. Let's
not even
look at
that. Yeah,
it's
right below that. New York Times Book Review.
Okay, so 158 There's... white women.
Mm-hmm. These bar graphs, like if you're listening to the show, click on the link in the show notes when you get a chance and look at these bar graphs.
It looks like
so
if you drop the Empire State Building into Dubuque, Iowa, is what these
really
bar
does.
Graphs look like.
So 158 white women, 16
Asians.
Who identified as Asian,
yep.
8 who identified as Black or African American,
yes.
3 Hispanic. As Hispanic or Latina, 2
unsure.
Identified as unsure. And 2 identified just as woman of color.
So 24, 27, 29, 29 mm-hmm. out of a total of 180.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
It's about a third of what a representative representation would be. And this is not mm-hmm. even the worst one. This is not even that bad compared to some of the others. Let's look at our good friends over at the New York Review of Books.
Oh, the New York Review of Books is so...
26 white women
it's
and
so...
1 Asian. And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, 2 women who only identify. So 3 out of 30, 10%. 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Where else can we go? Oh, the New Yorker. Let's look at that.
Yeah, the New Yorker's not great
56
either.
White women, 2 Asians, 3 Black African American, 2 Hispanic Latino, 4 other.
Mm-hmm. And the New Yorker, it's worth mentioning.
On the main Vita,
like,
looks pretty good. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Am I wrong?
On the main Vita, it's pretty, like, the New Yorker, it's pretty bad. There's not much change.
No.
Like the, and that's what I was looking for when I was looking at the primary count was who's in, not just where are they standing in absolute coverage
yes.
of men versus women, but how are they changing? And there's, like, no change in this New Yorker graph over the last 4 years. It's, like, very tall skyscrapers versus middling buildings. There's almost twice as many men on every year than there are women. Like, and this year it was 563 male writers and 280 female writers. And that's about the same proportion as the last 4 years. So they're just not even,
it's just, they don't care. Bad. I mean, I don't even know how many
we say it like over
through.
And over. If you consistently have numbers like this, you're either not paying attention at all or you're seeing your numbers and you don't care about them.
Yeah.
Cause if you do care, you take steps to not have this problem.
The Atlantic, 21 white women, 3 Asian women, 1 black African American.
Mm-hmm. One thing when we were talking about it behind the scenes that, we both thought was interesting is that in terms of the absolute numbers in the population, in the U.S. Yo. Population, there are more Asian women.
Oh, yes.
Represented in these publications relative to the presence of Asian women in the mm-hmm. American population, and that black women are underrepresented.
Underrepresented. Hispanic women are even worse here. Mm-hmm. Hispanic, Latino women especially. So I guess now this is the ground zero. Hopefully this is the worst this count ever looks like.
And Vita, you know, makes a lot of notes about how, of course, this count is incomplete. We weren't able to reach all of the women mm-hmm. from all of the publications. This is a starting point, and that they'll be refining their methodology over the coming years, and that they also hope to be able to roll out surveys and analysis of other key demographic questions in addition to gender and race, or to be able to make more granular analysis of them.
And there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons for this. Institutionalized bias is, you know, principal among them, but that takes a lot of forms. One of the forms is women not feeling welcome. Women of color not feeling like they're going to be published or taken seriously, or mm-hmm. they haven't gotten enough social signals that they have the goods, if that makes sense.
You know, I think we both have friends who work in publishing houses that have said, that have stories about being in meetings where it's not quite said out loud, but everyone knows that what's being said is like, well, we already have a black woman on this season's list. Like, we can only do one book by a black woman each season, and that slot's already taken.
We have heard that, yeah.
That those kinds of things are happening, and so that's the institutionalized side of it, institutional side of it. But the way that publications reach out to mm-hmm. writers, like what you're saying, if women of color are consistently rejected from things, at some point
they don't see women of color published in these things. So like, why should I even try?
Right. And so they don't feel welcome. And like, one of the things that Tin House talked about doing was not just relying on what came into the pitch inbox or what showed up in the slush pile, but actively going out and inviting women and women of color to submit things for their site, or for their publication. Websites are doing that. We do it explicitly in our call for applications. We should say we're currently in an open call for applications.
Mention that, of course,
for contributors. I think by the time this show drops, we'll be on like the last couple days of the call.
Yeah, you have until April 19th, something like that.
But you know, we have a lot of women writing for the site. We have a lot of people of color.
More, not as many as we'd like Riot. Should be said. We're not at that 35% number, but we're trying to get there.
We are trying to get there. And one of the things that we're doing in trying to get there is explicitly saying, we hope when you see Book Riot that you see people who look like you and you feel welcome to apply. But just in case you haven't seen it, you are welcome here and we want to read
your application. We've also gone outside of our normal open calls to recruit people mm-hmm. of color.
We have.
And it's, you know, that's part of what it takes if you care
and
about
it works.
Yeah, it does work. It does work. It's disappointing, but not surprising, which makes it somehow more disappointing.
Yeah, it's not surprising at all how bad these numbers are. And I'm even disappointed. Like, the regular count, just the presence of women count is good that it's, you know, that we're seeing some consistent improvement. But most of the numbers or a lot of the numbers are still not approaching parity, or there's still several years of improvement away from approaching parity. Like the write-up on Vita applauds the New Republic for the percentage jump that they mm-hmm. made in the last year, but it just, that jump just got them to 29% coverage of women.
Wonder if there's like people paying attention will lift the tide somewhat, but there's still friction at some level.
Oh, I'm sure there's,
you know,
still
there's
friction.
Where that still is going to be. Mm-hmm. And that'll be the harder thing. That's the thing that just measuring doesn't break you through.
Right.
Like if you want to save money, you can do all the, I want to save money and try. But if you only make so much money, yeah, it's hard to save enough for retirement, for example. Like there are other things that are going to need to change. And I don't know what they mean. I have some of my doubts that some of these longstanding institutions are even capable of parity. Or getting even, you know, within statistical error of parity.
I mean, I think it would be like looking at the nation.
Yeah.
There's a really wide gap of particularly the genders of the authors that are reviewed. Mm-hmm. I think it was only like 20% of the 20% of the books reviewed last year were by women. And that's the kind of thing that takes like, and you bring in a new editor, and
yes,
that new editor cleans house.
And maybe gets a 35%, you know, like to double is going to be hard.
Like, are they like clean house and get a whole new staff and roll in? Like, this is the way
that
we do things.
That's what the New Republic did.
Now, yeah.
That's what the New Republic did. You know, one thing you can do is something like BuzzFeed is doing. Did you? Come on.
Good come job on there.
BuzzFeed is starting a couple of new projects. They've had a book section for almost 2 years now, I want to say.
Yeah, a year or two.
Year mm-hmm. two. With Isaac Fitzgerald as the book editor over there, previously of The Rumpus. And Saeed Jones, who has been editing their LGBTQ vertical. I may have gotten those numbers.
And he's a poet. He has a great book
really
out
cool
called,
guy, Saeed Jones.
Prelude to
is their
Blues.
New literary editor. And they're starting a couple interesting things. One is a, I guess, a literary magazine of some kind that's going to come out next year. And it doesn't say if it's print only or digital only or what it's going to be.
Yeah.
But they're
short fiction, poetry, and lyric essays.
That sounds like a pretty typical literary journal in terms of format. But the other thing that Saeed and this new literary part of BuzzFeed is explicitly interested in is diversity of a bunch of different kinds. And part of that is they're going to be doing a new fellowship program in which they're going to have, let's see, a 4-month fellowship that's 12 grand. Basically, and they're going to have several of them available. So you can come and work on your whatever, your literary whatever. And I don't – it's cool. I mean, this is good, right?
I mean, this is one
thing that helps with diversity is giving people support that don't have another – you know, that aren't conventionally have access to standard ways of support.
Yeah, the Emerging Writer Fellowship is what it's called. And they're launching it they're launching the magazine in March of 2016. It doesn't quite say when the fellowships will be launched. I'm certain they're going to be overwhelmed with applications for it. But this is very cool. I think it's a large publication on the web, like BuzzFeed, for whatever you think of their content. I think Isaac has done a great job with the books vertical. They're huge. They understand how the social internet works and how to get the word out about things. There have been some great long form essays about diversity in publishing, about real serious issues in publishing. And BuzzFeed's platform is enormous. And I'm happy to see them giving their enormous platform over to talking about these big issues. And Saeed is so smart, so well respected. And this is, I think it's very cool. I trust this, you know, like sometimes people roll out new projects and you're a little bit like, oh, how is this? Like, it's a good idea, but how's it going to go with this person? I feel like he's the absolute perfect person to be doing this for BuzzFeed. And it's going to be cool to see emerging writers have an opportunity to spend time just working on their writing and having financial support for doing that when otherwise they, you know, would be having to pay their bills in some other way and might not be able to focus on their writing. There's been a lot of historical, you know, like privilege built into who gets to work in publishing and who gets published. Publishing has been built on unpaid internships for a long time. And there's this like storied, well-known history of one of the ways that you could afford to take an unpaid internship to get your foot in the door at like Random House was, you know, if you had a trust fund or parents who could pay for you and float your bills for you for a few years so that you could do
or
a job
you
that
at least
would get
didn't have
you
any college
industry.
Debt to also service as well or something like that.
If you're coming out of school with a lot of debt or you're coming from, you know, a less well-off financial situation, which very few people have that situation of the trust fund and no debt at all and parents that can pay for you, you know, for a couple of years. This gives opportunity to people who wouldn't normally have it. I think that's great.
Thinking about this, as New York has gotten exponentially more expensive just since we moved here 15 years ago now for me, it's even harder, I would think. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not the same city I moved to in 2000, which was still expensive even then, but, you know, if you're getting paid $33,000 a year, I don't know where you – I literally don't know where you live in New York for that much money, you know, without mm-hmm. subsidies, subsidized housing or a family support system or other outside money. It's crazy. So it's interesting. I'm going to be interested in saying that I guess the most interesting for me is that BuzzFeed is doing this at all.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's BuzzFeed,
yeah.
Right?
Right. I mean, they've been great about diversity in their own internal hiring. Like, they have a really interesting diverse editorial staff, at least on the culture stuff that I follow. I don't know how mm-hmm. the other stuff is. But so that it's clear that someone over there is paying attention. But I don't know why they want to do a literary journal. Like, why are they doing fellowships? Like, it's great, but I guess that just – I'm not sure why. They're like a huge digital startup. They've got like $100 million in funding. They do billions of page views a month. Like, I guess I'm just not sure.
It's – that piece of it is really curious. Like,
I'm not saying it's wrong or anything. I just don't get it.
No, but it's interesting. Yeah. Like, they're huge. BuzzFeed is getting – like exclusive access to big names.
President Obama does selfies for BuzzFeed on video.
Right. Or just within publishing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, publishers have given BuzzFeed exclusive access to big authors. Yep. They've done reveals of like book related.
John Green's come to their office to do videos.
Yeah, they're getting like whether or not publishing likes BuzzFeed's way of doing content or talking about books, which I kind of suspect publishing might not like because BuzzFeed is so we're similar to BuzzFeed in that way of like, it's, you know, it's casual and it's celebratory and it's enthusiastic and it's not about
being goofy
and
random. Yeah, it's, and whatever,
right. Yeah. There's gifts. Like, it's not about being a highbrow or a literary reader. BuzzFeed wants everybody in the door. But that doesn't seem to matter. Like, what publishing thinks of BuzzFeed's content doesn't seem to matter because BuzzFeed's audience is so big.
Yeah, when you have that many eyeballs.
Yeah, they
huge.
Want access to those eyeballs. And so they're giving BuzzFeed stuff. Like, you don't, if you're as big as BuzzFeed is, you don't have to have literary bona fides.
Yes. Well, and John Green is like, he's a pop culture person now. And, you know, like some of these things exceed what we consider.
Yeah, publishing. The literary journal thing to me, like, looked like a bid toward getting some literary bona fides and being taken seriously.
I guess to why I think you're about that, but why do they care? Interesting to me.
Well, I think that's just down to the people that are participating. You know, the Rumpus was very literary. Isaac Fitzgerald has that background of, you know, publishing literary essays and being one of the first people to have Cheryl Strayed's voice out in the world at the Rumpus. So that's the thing he cares about. You know, Saeed is
Roxanne
a poet
and at the Rumpus,
and an excellent literary writer. So this is, I think these people who run BuzzFeed Books and the literary vertical care very much about literary community. And Saeed is working on this fellowship to expand who we think of as members of the literary community and to have wider voices there. But it is interesting. Like, why does I don't know. And my bias is that I don't really care about literary journals at all.
Yeah, me neither,
so
really.
I'm surprised any time that, like, when we have the internet, someone
but
thinks
Isaac
that
and Saeed are way
a journal
more literary
is the way
than
to go.
You and I are. Like, they they have Emma. I don't know that.
Right.
I mean, they
but
write
still, like,
and
but,
they've
but,
done
like, they've,
poetry and stuff like that. Like, that's not something we do.
Like, we have the internet now to, and maybe the journal that they're doing is going to be an online journal, which would basically make it just a small site that publishes things rather than a print journal. And I could get my head around that more. Like, here's the digital platform where we publish literary things and BuzzFeed backs that. And maybe they use BuzzFeed's giant platform to point eyeballs at essays by literary writers that wouldn't get as many eyeballs if they were somewhere else, which that's great. Like, that's a cool way to, you know, point some attention at a more diverse group of writers. But yeah, I don't know.
I mean, maybe if you have $100 million in VC funding and you make $70 million a year, I mean, that's what BuzzFeed does. Maybe throwing, you know, $150,000 at a Saeed passion project is, you know, and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's not like a mission, you know, they're not staking the future of BuzzFeed on it. So right. Maybe in that, I'm overthinking it.
It's not a huge gamble to take, but it is, it's just not the kind of thing that we expect from BuzzFeed.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's interesting. We're going to pay attention to that. We got to wrap. What are we doing? We got to get out of here.
We got to do our last sponsor. Oh, yes, we got some new books, and I'll talk really fast.
Go to tryaudiobooks.com, and Random House Audiobooks is this cool site, tryaudiobooks.com, where they recommend audiobooks for you based on what kind of books you like.
And what activities you're doing.
Oh, I'm sorry. What kind of activities you're doing. And also what kind of books you like. You can figure out some of that there too. So the thing they're pointing us to this year, because it's spring. I mean, I keep telling New York, it's spring, man. And it's 35 degrees and raining here. But whatever. I hear other places there's this thing called spring happening.
I was on a beach this weekend.
No, that's not okay. Don't come. Why do you do that to me? So you can go to tryaudiobooks.com/gardening, and they give you some gardening picks there. But they also, if you check it out too, they have for crafting, road trips, you know, commuting, a whole bunch of things along those lines where you can try different, you know, different levels of heaviness, I guess you would say, different levels of different lengths and things like that. Man, I tell you what, I just was starting to, I'm starting to hear a girl on the train. Have you read it?
Yeah, I read
it. Okay. It became like a thing, and now I'm hearing from people I trust that it's a thing. So I don't know. I'm not going to put you on the spot right now, but I'm circling that one.
I'll tell you later.
Tell me later your review. But that's one I'm really looking at to look at. I mean, that's apparently a bit of a thriller. It's a page turner. We still don't have a good word for a page turner for an audiobook, right? So that's something we're still working on too.
It's like Miss Your Train Stop compelling.
You know, one thing that I've sort of suggested some other ways that people could use audiobooks to sort of fill out their lives, and I said video games and a bunch of other wonderful, smart ideas because obviously think of the source. I was regrouting our kitchen floor the other day.
Oh, buddy.
But you know what? Audiobook. Mm. You can listen to audiobook, regrout your floor. Makes it a little less terrible right there. Mm-hmm. So that's another one you might add to your list if you're getting into summer projects along those lines. Let me see. What else can I say? So yeah, you could regrout almost everything and listen to an audiobook. It could be your shower. You could regrout your tub, I guess.
I'm doing some spring cleaning, and there's definitely audiobook action happening.
Oh yeah, that's a really good idea. Spring cleaning is something you could probably gardening would be along the same lines if you want to do that as well. So anyway, there's a lot of interesting things you can listen to while you're listening to some audiobooks. So go to tryaudiobooks.com and get started right now. Okay, tell me about some books.
New books. Okay. Good stuff this week. The first is a big YA book, maybe one of the more anticipated ones of the year if the Book Riot contributor core is any measure. Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli. It's about a kid named Simon who's 16. He's gay. He is not totally out yet, but an email that he sends gets into the wrong hands somehow, teenagers being teenagers, and he's being blackmailed by a kid at his school. A mean kid that if he doesn't do what this kid wants him to do, the kid is threatening to out him. And so he then, you know, won't have control of how he reveals his identity to his peers. That sounds like a super compelling setup to me. Kelly Jensen, who works with us and is our resident YA queen of everything, has been recommending it widely. People have just been like popping up on Twitter to tell me how great this book is and to make sure that I've heard of it. I have heard of it. I'm super excited to read it. And that's out this week. Also looks like a great thing to be taking into the summer if you're looking to, you know, diversify your YA reading in any way. A great story about a kid from the LGBT community. That's one of them. Or if you're looking for good recommendations for teens in your life that care about identity and issues like that, and there you go. Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. It also just has a really great cover. I think that's a fun title. Like, everything about the package of this book is appealing to me. Also out is Orhan's Inheritance by Elene Ohanesian. This is a story that is, oh wait, I lost my notes. This is a sad day. Okay. So Orhan's brilliant and eccentric grandfather, who built a dynasty out of making rugs, is found dead in a vat of dye. And Orhan inherits the family business. But his grandfather's will raises a lot of questions as well. They left the family estate to a stranger thousands of miles away, this woman who's in a retirement home in Los Angeles. And her existence and the secrecy about her past deepen the mystery of why Orhan's grandfather would have done this. So in intent on righting this, righting the wrong, Orhan goes to LA and has meetings with this 87-year-old woman to unearth a family secret. And in the process, the story digs into the history of Turks and Armenians and a conflict that dates back to the Ottoman Empire. So you've got history and family secrets and scandal and a part of history and a cultural conflict that that I don't know very much about. So I'm looking forward to reading this and getting that as well. That's from Algonquin Books. They're doing some of the most interesting and most diverse titles that I've seen. Like one thing that I've been paying attention to this year is how diverse the books I get in the mail are. Mm-hmm. And they are not very, but Algonquin is doing a consistently great, interesting job. And Chris Bojalian, who's an author and a friend of the site, blurbed this one. And I trust that as well. So great reviews, hearing good buzz about Orhan's inheritance. And out in paperback this week is a book that I love, that I feel like I've been talking about a ton lately on the show. Daring Greatly, How the Courage to Be Vulnerable Transforms the Way We Live, Love, Parent, and Lead by Brené Brown. She's got some great TED Talks. She's a sociologist who spent her life studying how vulnerability works, basically, and what happens when we take the risk to be vulnerable, to show ourselves to people around us, to reveal our weaknesses in some way, and how ultimately taking that risk makes us stronger and better in our relationships with friends and family and coworkers. It changed my thinking about things, both big and small, in every different kind of relationship in my life. And I think it's a really great book, and it's out in paperback. So nice. It's cheaper now than it used to be. It would also be great on audio. It's from Penguin, but Penguin and Random House, together now. So if you're doing the Random House audiobooks thing, you could try out.
Very good idea. Very good idea.
Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. I think that's our
show.
I'm
wiped out, man.
I am too. This was a big one. Big we still show. Had things that we kicked off the agenda.
And I still Amanda have more things to say about some of the stuff we already covered. I feel very, very disheveled.
And you're going to be off next week. Amanda and I will have to talk about this Maya Angelou stamp thing.
Oh, good. I didn't want to talk about that. I really didn't want to.
Don't forget teespring.com/brpodcast for your Books Are In My Wheelhouse shirt.
Thanks to Squarespace, use offer code RIOT to get 10% off. Thanks to Scribd, go there. You can try Scribd.com, scribd.com/bookriot.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And try audiobooks.com/gardening.
All right. Thanks for sponsoring the show. Thanks so much last week for your great questions. We had a lot of fun doing the show, got a lot of good feedback about the show. And we'll see you next
Amanda
week.
And I got our tattoos last night.
Oh,
you did. For people
I was also going to mention, we're going to do a summer recommendation show, a mom's, dad's, grad's summer reading. So anything that falls into that, if you want a book recommendation for Mother's Day or Father's Day or someone's graduating from high school or college or for summer or just for yourself, just slide it all in there. It doesn't even have to be for one of those things. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. As always, you can find show notes. So we'll be taking those questions for the next few weeks and record a show. I think we'll get all three of us back on because that was fun. Mm-hmm. And then as always, you can find show notes for this episode and all previous episodes of the Book Riot Podcast at bookriot.com/podcast. Let's call it a show.
Have a good week.